Welcome to the Filibuster, the podcast of the Union University Political Science Department. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. Since the title of the podcast is The Filibuster, I'll throw out for some useless information here that World War I became an important point in the evolution of the filibuster. Due to senators filibustering appropriations for the war, the Senate imposed a cloture rule or a means of limiting debate. Today, we're not going to try to limit debate, but we are going to try to have a full and free discussion of the Ukrainian crisis. My name is Sean Evans. I am the host of the podcast. I am joined today by Greg Ryan, our professor of international relations, and Hunter Baker, the Dean of Arts and Science, who is also one of our political science professors. So let's get right to it, Greg. Why did Russia invade the Ukraine?
We can think about intent and capability. There's not really been much doubt that there was an intent by Vladimir Putin for some time, for some decades, that he would like to regain certain territories that were lost, not just to the Soviet Union, but to Tsarist Russia, which had been part of Tsarist Russia for many centuries. The question comes down to capabilities, and capabilities don't depend just on what one possesses, but what opportunities one is given. Putin has moved before. In 2008, he went into Georgia and peeled off two provinces. In 2014, he went into Crimea. And now he's gone into Ukraine. 60% of the Russian economy is based on oil. The U.S. administration and those that influence it really have a very different vision of the world. They have shut down a percentage of natural gas and oil production in this country. They gave the green light for Russia to open the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Now, they've since rescinded that. But for the last year, Russia has done well. Russia has, and they've stocked up about, $650 billion in economic reserves to prepare for this, which has been padded by high oil prices, which everyone is aware of. That's one capability that was there. The other thing is I think they see a rather, I'll put it charitably, inflexible administration in the United States, one that does not react nimbly to things, that certainly did not execute the Afghanistan pullout in a commendable way. It was, if not now, when? Concatenation of circumstances provided the best opportunity. Also, there are certain, effects related to weather and armor. And also European reliance on Russian natural gas, which will be less in the summer. But that is kind of why it surprised us. A lot of people thought it would have already happened, right? Last week we were thinking, well, it would have already happened if it was going to happen. Maybe it'll happen next year. So what do you know?
Okay, so part of what you have said is that Putin has won this war for years and that the current administration has sent signals that potentially encouraged him to do this. Are there other things that happened that helped us reach to this point?
Well, there has been a diplomatic process to deal with these areas of the Donbass region that are primarily Russian-speaking and Russia-affiliated. The Europeans pushed a diplomatic process, which we could have approved in 2015. We chose not to do so.
Because this was after the Crimea,
yes, because it was
annexation.
That would be, yes, ostensibly, yes, one of the reasons. But the other thing I would say is that under Donald Trump, Russia did not whatever the relationship there, and there was much deception about it in the United States. We didn't have a problem with Russia, at least with Russian aggression across borders. That did not happen under Donald Trump. And I think that's because they thought they could bargain with Trump. What they're dealing with now, they don't, and I think this may be true of other areas of the world also. Western elites have essentially said, we're moving on to a different type of economy. We don't care what anybody else thinks. So I think there's also pressure in that situation. But standard American, I would say, inattention to local issues, relevant history in specific places, I think that plays a role too.
Okay. Well, a couple things I'll add with this. I think you're saying you are correct that Russia did not invade international boundaries during the Trump administration, but Trump also helped advance Russian ideas in that he wanted to destabilize the West, and that's why he has supported or Russia has supported other populist-type people for that. Now, that doesn't mean that the populist did not have a good point to make, but he knew that Trump would be gas on a fire that already existed, which would help divide the West even more. And so I think that plays
well,
a role in that also.
I would say that the Western press, some Western press organizations still keeping Pulitzer Prizes that they won for saying Trump was a Russian agent.
Right.
That wasn't Trump's
right.
fault. Okay.
No, right, right. But I'm not saying that Trump was a agent of Russia. I think that
But you will agree that the mainstream press said for 3 years under no uncertain terms that he was.
Right. But the point I guess I was making is that Putin wanted to see division within the West, and Trump was someone who helped exacerbate the existing tensions, which made democracy look a little bit less appealing, and also divided the West, which helped set him up in some way to be ready to move into Ukraine and to try to play a larger role on the international stage.
I don't deny that he wants that the Russians, be they communist or 21st century Russians, have wanted to sow division in the West and have been smiling when there's division in the West. However, 2 years ago, while we were talking about problems in Ukraine, and there's a sordid history there, we don't know all the facts, that there was not any pressure for another Russian geopolitical move on the ground. That has come about in the last year. One of the things that's abetted it is a choice, and people would say it is a moral choice, right? Not to tap our own domestic energy reserves. It offered a
right.
terrific opportunity.
Well, that's something we'll get to a little bit later. We also have to, I think, point a finger at Europe and what they have done in becoming more reliant on Russian energy, especially Germany, who is the leader of Europe, whether they want to admit it or not. And by being so reliant on Russian energy, it makes it more difficult for them to try to lead a coalition to push back, and it makes them vulnerable to Russian pressure.
Absolutely. But the point was, is the U.S. said, we will not replace Russia and supply you energy, right? We don't even have enough for our own domestic consumption now. So whatever Germany's leanings, we pushed them towards Russia. This administration did that. It was a stated alternative.
Okay, well,
it was a stated objective of the last administration to sell natural gas
right.
to Europe.
And I would say the previous administration was trying to promote more drilling. But I think it's wrong to say it's just solely this administration's fault, because you could go back to Gerhard Schroeder, who was the former chancellor of Germany, who became the chairman of the Russian gas company, pipeline coming into Germany. So the move to become more reliant on Germany is longstanding. In fact, reflects social democratic ideas going back to Willy Brandt of an Ostpolitik.
Ostpolitik. There's been an on and on. It goes back to the Germans training an air force secretly in Russia in the 1920s. I mean, we can go back even farther than that. The point is that current policies encouraged. There's certainly been a German-Russian relationship which has vacillated between helping one another at times and outright slaughter of one another at times, going back quite a while. But I would say that there's been a stark difference in the energy policy of the two administrations.
Yes.
And that has had a major impact on Putin's decision to go.
Well, right, but I think we may get to the point to where it sounds like you're trying to blame the Biden administration for this, and I don't think that's what you're trying to say.
Well, at some level, I'm certainly trying to say that.
Well, on some level. I think the large point we need to keep in mind, though, is Ukraine has been a sovereign nation. Russia has respected it. They made an agreement to this back in the 1990s. They created other type of agreements about how to resolve problems, and they have violated that repeatedly. And so I think—
As have we, okay? Let me make that clear. And this is not to whitewash anything that Putin has done. But we certainly made statements about the expansion of NATO in the 1990s that we would not do it. And then— We said, well, we're on the right side of history. We will do it, right?
Well, it's we have consistently said that Ukraine is not ready for NATO, and it will be years and years away for that. So to say that something so far in the future is a proximate cause for this, I think may be pushing it a bit.
I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying other former satellite states, obviously in Eastern Europe, but also former Soviet republics have been brought into NATO, which was a direct contradiction to promises that were made in the early 1990s. Now, we made a promise to Ukraine to protect them also if they give up nuclear weapons, okay?
Right.
And see, that one's really important. I mean, the reality is that if Ukraine still had the nuclear weapons, and I understand that, you know, they weren't equipped to have them or to take care of them or to steward them, but if they were still there, this might be an entirely different picture right now.
But what you're talking about is statesmanship, which thinks about long-term issues. Okay?
Yeah.
And frankly, I think I know this from people I talk to. I would reference the UN ambassador's comments that it's 2022. This kind of thing can't happen in 2022. Which is rooted in a worldview that somehow we are progressing toward a society where coercion is not used. Right?
I want to jump in at that point, and maybe this will give, you know, both of you can kind of comment on this. But one of the things that strikes me is that you have this kind of post World War II order and this development of international norms, and you know the idea that. So the natural resource questions are not going to be so big because there'll be an international market and you can kind of get what you need, you know, stuff like that. And developing international law and ideas such that is, you know, that you're not going to invade a sovereign nation. And it seems to me that one of the things we've seen during the past, you know, 20, 30 years is that Russia and China have both kind of been more on the side of saying, we don't really want to hear all this stuff about international norms, right? You know, that we're going to do what's in our interest. And I'm not saying the rest of us don't do what's in our interest, but I think that they have been particularly resistant to that discourse, right? And now they're backing each other up in this thing, right? And basically China is saying to Russia to some extent, make your play, right? We're gonna be there to backstop you. And I think what this also reflects is that China, they are increasingly confident, I think, that they're going to keep that domestic market for themselves, and they're not going to need the West so much anymore, right? And I mean, I think all that is kind of playing out right now, and it just seems to me that if Putin is not stopped right here, that's going to embolden China, and it just feels like Taiwan will just fall right in its wake.
Well, that's a lot. You said a lot at the end.
Yeah, I did. I know I did.
We could take a part. We could take those piece by piece. I'll defer to the moderator for now.
Let's kind of stick to the big world order.
Okay.
What
all right.
question and skip Taiwan for?
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. That's. I think that's a good way to proceed. Although I would say that the Belt and Road Initiative might benefit from a stronger Russia, perhaps. Okay.
Do you agree with the characterization I made of Russia and China as kind of resisting?
Well, I'll quote Robert Caro on this. He says, "Power doesn't corrupt; power reveals." Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're back to what is their intent? Their intent hasn't changed. Their capabilities changed, so we hear about it more, and we see them acting more, right? But yes, they do not. I mean, this has been John Mearsheimer talks about this. You know, we assumed with China and to a degree Russia that because we won the Cold War, they would just adopt democracy and allow free market forces to play the way we wanted them to play. Well, that was a very bad assumption on our part.
Yeah, I think on some level what Russia moving into Ukraine says is kind of the final nail in the U.S.-led world order in the sense to where Russia said, we'll do what we want, and there's really not much you can do about that.
I would say don't let the U.S. world order hear you say that. But.
Well, right. Well, but the thing I would also say is that they don't like the way the world order, I know that's a vague concept.
Well, it communicates, though.
With that, to where they want to change it to where they're going to play a more prominent role. I think that's what you see Russia doing, that they're punching above the weight in Syria, the Middle East, and now in Europe, saying you're going to have to pay attention to us. I might say that China has a slightly different view, and you can disagree with me, Greg. China has benefited from the system on some level, and I think they're trying to change the system within the system, because they're trying to take over UN agencies and other kinds of things to rewrite the rules from within. Well, I think Russia may be trying to rewrite the rules from without.
Well, certainly China has benefited over the last 30 years from the present world order much more than Russia. There's no question about that. China's still continuing to benefit from it, but they're also have made through things like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the New Development Bank. They're also, at some level, trying to create a parallel order. They're doing both. And, if you can, why wouldn't you?
Right.
But yes, they have certainly have done different things through aid to African countries, among other regions, to try to get people from those countries placed in leadership of certain UN organizations.
Okay, we'll come back to this in a little bit, but let's go back to look at the Russia and Ukraine situation a little bit more specifically. What would a Russian victory over the Ukraine look like?
Okay, I've been guessing on this, and I'm going to continue to guess. My guess is what the Russia wants to do is to go up to the Dnieper River, which essentially, maybe that's 40%, 35% of Ukrainian territory on the Russia side. That means taking everybody is calling it Kyiv now. Kyiv or Kiev, have your pick.
The Brits still call it Kiev.
Okay, I'm going to call it Kiev.
Yeah.
Because the Dnieper River splits it. And getting rid of the Zelensky government. There's almost no question that they want to get rid of. They would like to capture it. Zelensky is now saying, you won't take me alive, essentially.
Well, that's probably accurate one way or the other.
Yep. Probably accurate one way or the other.
It's as close as the next cup of tea.
Yeah. and leaving a kind of a rump state in Western Ukraine, which is a buffer state and cannot be a member of NATO. I think that Russia would gladly take that.
Okay, so
I don't think it's that easy, but I think they'd gladly take it.
Okay, so the idea is that it would be a puppet state then is their goal.
Well, they would like the eastern part would be under Russian control. Yes. The rump state would be they would like to have some influence over its government. Not necessarily control it. And they might even be happy with an Austria-like situation, after the Russians pulled out of Austria in the 50s, right? A dedicated buffer state.
Right. We'll get to whether Ukraine can, whether they would put up with the puppet state. But before we get there, is there any chance that Ukraine can put up a fight against Russia?
Well, that depends on how much outside help might come. But I would say that there seems to be determination there. And in my mind, at least right now, there's no question this is going to be an incredibly bloody conflict. Because, they've handed out 18,000 assault rifles to civilians. They're telling them to make Molotov cocktails. And you have, of course, below the uniformed military level, you've got Russophiles in Ukraine that are supporting the Russian forces and Ukrainians who are against. Even if the Russians are able to nominally take control of certain areas, those pockets of Ukrainian resistance could be fierce. Okay.
Okay. So, do you anticipate troops entering Russia? Enter into Kiev and a fight to the government house.
I think that's increasingly likely. Yes, I've heard the last reports that I've gotten were that artillery is probably self-propelled artillery is falling. Artillery rounds are pretty indiscriminate, right? The Russians were trying at first to do it as surgically as possible, but this is kind of a rumor that the generals have essentially gone back to Putin and said, we can't get it done that way. You essentially take the restrictions off, right? And artillery falling on Kiev, it would be one indication of that.
Okay, so you're saying then they might be able to decapitate the government, but they're going to face a long insurgency.
Potentially, yes.
Okay, how would something like that play into Putin's internal politics?
Well, he certainly there are peace movements within the country, but he's done a pretty good job over the last 10 years of securing the oligarchs as part of the state, okay? Mm-hmm. So if he loses, they lose. Targeted sanctions against oligarchs to try to get them to turn against Putin, I don't think that will work. And the fact that we're not sanctioning oil,
which is, as you said, 60% of the Russian economy.
There's a question about the international money transfer system, SWIFT, and whether we would deprive the Russians from that. That would certainly hurt them for a time. But the Chinese have a system, CIPS, processing system is the PS. It's another type that it can't do everything SWIFT does because it doesn't have as many parties to it. But I assume the Russians are already using that at some level, and they would probably just completely go over to that.
So you don't see SWIFT as the major sanction
I don't think it would be a backbreaker. I think it would certainly have an effect, but I don't know that it would be the backbreaker. Russia has – some of this is baked in, right? They know that certain sanctions are probably coming. That's why they built up economic reserves and other types of reserves and contingency plans, which they're obviously moving toward now.
Well, let me ask this question. So, you know, if I listen to Michael O'Hanlon, Brookings Institution, you know, kind of one of the elite sort of talking heads of American foreign policy, right? He seems to feel that Russia has made a terrible mistake. I mean, you know, his language is is that they had a choice to make between military honor and adventuring and having a functioning economy. And in his perspective, Russia has chosen not to have a functioning economy or to lose the ability to have a functioning economy.
Yeah.
Do you think that O'Hanlon is just like, he just doesn't see this thing correctly or what?
Yeah, generally I think he doesn't see it correctly. Okay. but there are details that he might see correctly.
Yeah.
But I know less about, I want to be characterize what my answer. I know probably more about his view of the world than I do about the Russian economy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just know that the assumption 30 years ago about China was they're either going to become democratic or their system will fail. There are only two choices. That was essentially the Western viewpoint. That was very wrong. It refused to acknowledge certain potentialities, right? So when something like this happens, which again, so much of the viewpoint is nobody would actually use force to go across a border. We're too civilized for that now. They do assume only bad things can happen to the perpetrator of something like that. And I would say that's there are a lot of things to happen before we know that.
Right. So, yeah, I think in looking at this, I think if he has a quick victory, Putin gets a short-term bump, but I think an insurgency can cause him trouble long-term, just like we saw with Iraq and Afghanistan, and Russia has an experience with Afghanistan also. The question is as you point out, the insurgency and what form that takes. So that leads us to the next question.
Well, let me before you get there, real quick. You know, one thing that I have wondered about I almost said Khrushchev, Putin. I'm thinking about Khrushchev in the context of Putin. Is that Khrushchev? You know, eventually he gets put out to pasture, right? You know, he goes on vacation and he comes home and he's no longer in charge. Is Putin in any danger of that happening to him? You know,
again, much less danger than in the past, because he has battled it out with Russian oligarchs. Right? He put one in prison. He essentially kicked another one out, and he may have murdered one. But after doing that, right? I mean, it's standard mafia tactic, right? You neutralize some, and you pay off the others. Yeah. You link them to the system. So if he goes, they fall too. Right. Okay. I think that it's much less likely than the dynamics that were there with the Supreme Soviet and, you know, 60 years ago.
Okay, so what can be done?
Well, obviously, turning on natural gas in the United States would be, I think, the most effective thing we could do and the easiest thing we could do from the perspective of most Americans. It's just the powers that be, those that have strong influence with this administration, are against that, plain and simple. We'll see what the pressure from the Republicans is to do it.
Well, I think there's two ways of looking at that. One is, yes, we should increase production in the U.S. We are the Saudi Arabia of natural gas, for instance. But the thing also to realize is getting that production up and running and ready to be sent to the coast, to move to Europe and other places for them to get the
I want to get to Tennessee
and other things. Well, still, yes, we're still looking at a long-term
which gets, again,
right,
to the view of this administration, which made this ridiculous policy. Right?
Well,
because you can't turn it right back on. It's just one more point of the foolishness, but I don't think it's foolishness. I think it's a very intentional policy that they have made, which hurts most Americans in the short term at best. We could, being charitable, we could say.
See, to me, this so look, the ability to remedy the situation we're in now. I mean, that's not really there. But that having been said, I think that this, that what has occurred has demonstrated the irresponsibility and naivete of the American environmentalists. I mean, the fact is, so they're constantly trying to crimp oil production and push it back and, you know, and increase the price with the goal of diminishing usage and transitioning to electric. And I understand all that. But that's going to be a long process.
Right.
You know, it's going to take a long time to achieve. And in the meantime, the U.S. is one of the major producers. And to the extent that we ratchet that back in pursuit of this environmental policy, all we do is strengthen the hand of nations like the Russians.
I mean, and Iran and others.
That's right.
Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Russia.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
In this regard. Yeah, I think that is a good point. I think, though, if you listen to people on the left, they're saying this is the reason to double down on
John Kerry
on renewable energy.
It just won't be fast enough.
I understand the concerns about climate change. I know we can disagree on the impact and the future and all that. But it seems to me if you're the environmentalist movement and you want to move there, you need a bridge. Because we don't have the technology and everything else at this point to do what they would like. And so we need the bridge of natural gas, nuclear.
Much cleaner.
Yeah.
Natural gas is much cleaner.
Is much cleaner, in which case to get eventually to what they would want, though, I think we still have a long ways to go for that. And I think that would help us fight, probably not the right word, put us in a better position to weaken Russia and other nations. I think the EU has talked about we just need to wean ourselves off Russian oil and natural gas as much as possible, and they're talking about doing that by the end of the decade, which then reduces the potential influence that Russia has at that point because their leverage over Europe would be less.
But your point, I think one of your points, I mean, I'll just elaborate, from a strict how much greenhouse gases is global petrol use is going to put in the environment, from an environmentalist answer, we should be using natural gas more than
coal.
Coal or crude, right?
Right.
So the outcome, we can claim, we're not responsible for this, but because we've decided not to be responsible, the situation is much worse than if we had used the natural gas, just from a strict environmental standpoint.
And they should want to, instead of doing things like shutting down the XL pipeline, they should want to use pipelines instead of train cars and semi-trucks to transport these goods. That's actually a lower emission alternative. But the other thing I want to say is that as you point this out about the EU and other things is that This doesn't play out great in the long run for Russia because what happens is so let's say that the EU succeeds in going in the direction that you suggest. So then what happens to Russia? Basically, they're the gas station for China.
Yes.
Is that an attractive future? You know, I don't think so.
Well, I think, and Greg can probably talk about this more, I think that puts them in China's pocket.
Exactly.
Which I don't believe Putin would like to be any more than he's in the West's pocket.
Right.
Well, I mean, we talked about relations, long-term, you know, relations between Germany and Russia. We can also talk about long-term relations between Germany and China. They tend to be at their closest when there is a Western threat. When the Western threat ebbs, or just stabilizes, for instance, in the late 1950s, the Chinese and the Russians tend to go their separate ways and may throw rocks at each other or more, right? Anybody who's assuming very stable, long-term Sino-Russian relations is probably in for a surprise or two.
I think I might agree with you, Hunter, that this is going to backfire against Putin long-term in a couple ways. One, he has solidified NATO. You heard the German top military commander saying, what can we do? We've hollowed ourselves out. I think you're probably, and even Macron has said we need to start investing more in defense. I think you see that. I think we see more unity among Europe, which would allow them to potentially say we need to cut some of our ties to Russia. You even have like Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria, who traditionally are closer to Russia, have said, whoa, this goes too far.
I've seen the calls for tightened NATO unity. I'm still uncertain about it. That this is going to be a loser ultimately for Putin, I'm uncertain about that. Hmm. We look at Georgia and we look at Crimea and we think about the coverage of it at the time. Now those were cleaner operations. Right. Okay, they were more of a fait accompli type operation. I grant you that. But at the time, people were outraged. They were shocked. They said, how can this happen?
Right. But I think this is a little bit different because the invasion occurred in Europe. And I think that's different than what occurred in Georgia. And you have all these Eastern European countries who fear that Russia is trying to extend their sphere of influence over them, and they don't want that. I think that Putin has also increased Ukrainian nationalism, which makes that insurgency that much more challenging for him in the long run.
Look, Ukraine is not, it's not Poland. It's not Hungary. We're talking about an area that was part of Russia for six centuries, probably. The abstract kind of freedom lost anywhere is freedom lost everywhere, I think, is a poor, and I've heard some on the right make this argument, I think is a poor guide to understanding this. And, you know, the Russians, they don't think it's Europe. They think that Ukraine is part of Russia, always has been. We're only talking about 30 years of Ukrainian independence in the last, you know, 800 years or something like that.
I hear that, and I mean I can understand that, but there's also a sense in which, I mean, let's just imagine that Mexico became substantially more powerful and wealthy than they are, and a big military. None of us would be cool with it if they're kind of like, well, the Southwest was always part of Mexico. You know what I mean? Yeah. We're coming for Texas. We're coming.
Well,
we would never tolerate that. You know what I mean?
170 years and being a world power,
yeah,
in our right would qualify, yeah, that situation a little more.
Yeah.
Right. Ukraine is not a world power. They haven't.
I get that, but it's also, you know, just sort of these, again, it gets back to these norms that we have, right? The idea that there's such a thing as a sovereign nation. And that Ukraine has been acknowledged as a sovereign nation. And by the way, let's get cynical. You know, the Soviets after World War II, darn it, they wanted Ukraine treated like a sovereign nation in the United Nations, right?
Yep.
Because they wanted that vote.
They wanted right? Votes for all of their republics.
Exactly.
Now, they didn't get it.
Yeah,
right.
But they did for like a couple of them, didn't they? I think they may have. I think
only
they
for satellites, not for Soviet republics.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about the long-term plan for this. What can be done short-term, or what should the U.S. or the West be thinking about doing short-term?
I think assessment of partisan strength. And
meaning what?
Partisans within the occupied, if it becomes
insurgents,
settled,
then
right,
yeah, okay,
what that is, and how we can make it more effective, right?
So, is this something where NATO or the U.S. should consider arming the insurgency?
Well, yet again, this administration, right? The previous administration did arm Ukraine generally. This administration made the decision not to do so.
Well, and the previous administration also tried to blackmail the use of defense funding to get things out of Ukraine, for which there is absolutely no evidence for.
What's that? Be clear about it.
In terms of the Hunter Biden, Hillary Clinton thing, because Joe Biden was not a decision maker. He was implementing the policy of the administration.
Well, I think we probably disagree about Hunter Biden's laptop. You may think
No. This has nothing to do with the laptop. It was Trump's conspiracy ideas that Ukraine had all this information. It was more about how Joe Biden tried to stop the investigation.
He's on tape saying that he did.
No, what he was doing was trying to get someone replaced so that the investigation would continue. So the whole idea about this, previous administration looking at things differently, they did, but also they were reacting
to certain circumstances. You
have to remember that the previous administration was forced to do things against Russia by Congress because the sanctions against Russian passed over a Trump veto. Let's not praise.
I will praise the previous administration. I understand you won't. The context of much of this is, again, the fact, and I have said this many times, that when the media is allowed to mount a campaign, a smear campaign against a sitting president with no evidence, there have been no apologies for it, and expect there to be problems related to that part of the world later, not just at home, but there too.
All right. Let me come back in for a second. I have two questions about this, all right? So one about the previous administration. And then one about the point I raised earlier. So previous administration. One question I have is, and this is kind of a political statesman question. We remember that in Vietnam, Henry Kissinger would sometimes play up Nixon as a madman, right? You know, to use as a bargaining chip. I have sometimes wondered if Putin would have made these same moves if Donald Trump was in office.
I thought about this, out of the
sheer unpredictability, you know, like you do something like this and Trump takes it the wrong way, you have no idea, right, what will happen. That's the first question. You answer that, and I'll come back after that.
Okay, so yeah, the madman theory.
Yeah.
It all depends upon whether you believe he's a madman or he is incompetent. And that's what it comes down to. Would Russia have invaded if Trump was president? I don't think so, because Putin would think he could get what he wanted from Trump in the first place to where he wouldn't have needed that. I think Putin viewed Trump as a useful idiot
He'd be able to get control over Ukraine?
I think Trump would have been willing to say, as he said now, is it has nothing to do with us. We don't care, which would have then put more pressure on Zelensky and others to give in because their bargaining advantage, as little as it was, from having an impact. I mean, there would be no reason for Putin to go in because he is accomplishing his goals in other ways.
But see, I have the thought, and again, I'm not, you know, outside of my area of expertise, but it seems to me that Trump was working really hard to get the NATO members to build up on defense, to spend more on defense. With the kind of stuff that Putin is doing right now, I think that Trump would claim total vindication for, you know, the way he interacted with the NATO members, which is what I think
I don't think anyone disagrees that the NATO members in Europe should be up in their spending, and they should have done it decades ago.
Right.
And Trump was right on that.
Right. So I think that he would then double down on, you know, preventing Putin from taking this kind of action. Now, you know, and I say all that, having been kind of a maximum skeptic of the collusion theory, right?
Sure.
Okay. Now,
and that's understandable.
But let me go to the second thing, which I think is actually much more important. And I would love it if both of you guys would say, Hunter, you're worrying for no reason. I'm convinced that if Putin succeeds in dealing with Ukraine in fairly short order and gets what he wants, that China will simply take it as a cue that, okay, we've seen Afghanistan, we've seen Ukraine, now we can just roll into Taiwan and take Taiwan. I
want to react to this because the point is, yeah, is you can't roll into the Ukraine.
Yeah. Yes.
You can't roll into Taiwan.
Well, you, okay? you take your ships and your planes, right? You know,
well,
I mean,
it gets to make one point. Look, the Wehrmacht was much stronger than the British Army.
Yeah.
In the summer of 1940.
Yeah.
But Sea Lion never happened, right? 20 miles of water mattered. 120 miles of water really matter.
Okay.
But I'll go back to the thing I talked about, the factor on the ground in Ukraine. What's the level of resistance going to be? What's the level of, let's call it PLA, PRC, CCP, fifth column loyalty of certain people in Taiwan?
Yeah.
That would be a factor, and none of us at this table have a lot of awareness about that. Right.
I really wonder.
Water matters.
Coming from you, somebody who has, been out there on the ocean on a ship, I get that, right? And not a cruise ship, a military vessel.
I want the cruise ship.
But that having been said, I just wonder the degree to which China is going to look out there and say, the will is not really there to stop us, and people are going to throw a bunch of sanctions stuff.
Look,
we don't care.
Right.
You know, we're going to take what we want. We same kind of logic as you gave earlier. This has always been part of China. We don't acknowledge this, and
yeah. Well, and I do look. I think they think this administration is incompetent. I think that is their perception. I think there are questions, and it's certainly been reported in foreign news, whatever anybody at this table thinks, that this president has some mental capacity issues related to his age.
But that having been said, I mean, look, I kind of would say about that the same thing I would say when people were really freaking out about Trump. You still have this just large number of responsible people who are around at all times, right? I mean, who are still kind of running the government, you know? I mean,
But how well are they doing it? Again, when you have
it's not going super well at the moment,
right?
Yeah.
I mean,
okay. So I'm in the uncomfortable position of defending Biden here.
That's all right. He needs some defense on the show at the moment.
Yes, Afghanistan pullout was a disaster. It hurt U.S. credibility. I think if we look at what he's done over the past few months, is he has worked to keep to get Europe behind sanctions. They're all singing from the same song sheet at this point. They were releasing all this information about what Russia was doing and all this, not to really deter, because I don't think Putin cares, but I think it's helped, at least in the global world, help the world see Putin as the aggressor, because this idea of dirty tricks and, the Ukraine did this, they were pointing things out to where no, people weren't going to believe that. So I think they did a good job in frame this for the world in keeping Europe together so far. The big question is what happens next and what's going to go forward to whether they can actually get Europe to up its defense spending, whether they can continue to stay on the same page, whether they can get Europe to lessen its reliance on Russian oil and natural gas. But yeah, they've made mistakes. The Trump administration made mistakes. The Obama administration made some mistakes. The Bush administration made mistakes. We could go back and say that there were a series of actions taken over the past few decades that helped put us in this position.
Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, everything that's happening right now has got to have a very sobering sort of an effect upon policymakers in the West.
What I would say is different about this administration than all of the other administrations is, look, they're not ready to make trade-offs related to environmentalism. Okay, that is very different. Okay,
right.
that is a clean break that we have the ability to do this, and to be energy self-sufficient and say no, we're not going to do that. Right.
I think that's the top.
I think it's lunatic.
I think that's the top priority of their funders. I mean, I think that the people who are the big givers in the party, they've kind of gathered around that as the primary objective, and so he needed to deliver when he was elected, and he did so. And unfortunately for him, that approach has aged badly in this period that we're in.
Well, our time's running down. Let's kind of have a few quick questions and quick answers, if possible. First, how widespread could this conflict get?
I mean, from my perspective, it could easily grow into something bigger. I mean, I'm certainly worried about that. I've already alluded to my fear that it will have knock-on effects and lead to Taiwan and things like that. So I think it could easily grow into a larger conflagration. And just real quick, I think some of those former Soviet-dominated territories like Poland, I think they're going to be getting very anxious and very active very soon.
Well, I've heard that the Poles are attempting to deliver anti-tank missiles maybe to the Ukrainians. What's the method of that delivery? You're back to what are the insurgency forces, but how do you get things to them? And you wonder about if one of the near neighbors, Poland, even Hungary, was doing that and was on Ukrainian territory. They interacted with the Russians. There was a firefight. What are NATO's? What are the ramifications for NATO then? So it's very hard to know, but it's potentially extremely scary.
Right. Well, I guess I think they might probably try to limit this to the Ukraine because I don't think they.
That's what we're all hoping.
They want to go further. The question is: does Putin come back with cyber attacks, and then do we respond? And what happens in the escalation? Okay. Could this conflict lead to NATO expansion, in particular Sweden and Finland?
I haven't looked at that much. I know they went to the meeting with NATO. I think that they would probably, the countries that aren't even full members of the EU yet have some rights, maybe some arrangement like that could be made, especially under certain contingencies.
Okay. What's the impact of the refugee crisis for Europe? Will probably be an impending refugee crisis for Europe as people flee the Ukraine.
It's potentially different than other refugee crises because maybe there's not as much religious difference and ethnic difference. There'll be some impact, but it could be less because of those factors.
That's an interesting question to me because clearly a lot of the stress from the other refugees were they were Muslim, right? I mean, and there's a pretty significant culture clash. You know, even in super tolerant Sweden, there's tremendous angst over the number of Muslims in Sweden. This group of people is, you know, what, like 98% Christian or something like that, you know, at least nominally. But on the other hand, I think about Brexit, and one of the complaints that you sometimes heard from the British in Brexit was there are so many Polish people, you know, in England.
There are questions of what function do they fulfill in the economy? What economic aid are they going to get? Those questions.
Exactly.
You know.
Okay. I think what are the economic impacts beyond inflation going up as the price of energy increases, which leads to higher cost of utilities, transportation, and things like that. What other economic concerns should we expect to occur in the U.S. and globally?
Well, I really think that the Fed is concerned that they have totally gotten behind the curve on inflation. I think that they recognize that what they said about any inflation will be transitory was Either they were just saying what was convenient to get through the next meeting, which is sometimes what I think, or they just totally missed it. But the reality is inflation is approaching shocking levels. I think that they are scrambling. You know, they're talking about more than your typical quarter basis point, you know, increases. And what we know from the last time they had to react to inflation was basically they broke the economy. I mean, you had very severe recession after Reagan took office that was a direct result of the Fed trying to arrest strong inflation. And it worked, and, you know, recovery is pretty quick. It won't be fast enough to save the Biden administration
sure.
at the midterms.
Right.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is that this can easily throw us into recession, full-on recession.
Okay. How will the U.S. be affected in ways other than what we have already discussed?
I would say that in the developing world, they're probably having a wait-and-see attitude. It's very interesting. I've heard a report that Brazil's vice president condemned the Russian invasion, and then Bolsonaro told him to take it back. So, you know, the China-Brazil relationship is one that is at times can has some glue on anti-Westernism. I think the developing world
the
is taking a wait and see.
The BRICS, right?
Right. India, yeah. We're not so concerned with because of their problems with China,
yeah.
Although that's more complex too. But if Putin is somewhat successful, they may say the Western world's getting a black eye. We have this confusion. We always talk about the world community. We're talking about us and Western Europe and assuming everybody else is going to come along. We did that because we had enough power. But is the power has become more distributed. I think more countries not immediately affected will take a wait-and-see approach to the impact of this.
Okay. Any domestic political implications of this for Biden or anyone else?
Yeah, I mean, things are shaping up real well for him to become Jimmy Carter, right? I mean, that's similar stuff, right? You know, the environmental energy type stuff, the aggressive Russia type stuff,
Inflation.
The inflation. I mean, so many of those same elements are there, right? And he's going to get blamed for it, fairly or not. And you're going to have Donald Trump over there making the argument that some of his policies and views are vindicated by this. And I think he will find a receptive audience with a lot of people in that regard. And, you know, when things get bad, I think that that's when people look to a leader more of that type, right? You know, kind of the one who promises that they'll restore order. So I think he'll look more appealing in that sense. So, yeah, I think that the next president is very likely to be a Republican unless things turn around very quickly. And certainly we'll see just a big change in Congress.
Well, and I would say still we're waiting and seeing. Will there be some type of centrist movement within the Democratic Party, right, reacting to these things?
That's a great point.
I mean,
that's a
great. Well, that it can't automatically be ruled out.
There's a big opening there, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I want to hear. I'm looking at Sean because this is kind of his wheelhouse, right?
In terms of a centrist movement, I mean, the problem we have is that we have elite-dominated politics. The elites are not in touch with their base, much less the American people. The elites in both parties are out of touch. They're more extreme than the people are. So I don't see a centrist-type movement occurring in either party anytime soon. And so I think we will continue to struggle with political instability.
Well, I mean,
with the ricocheting back and forth in terms of policy.
Look, I think that the majority of people in this country want something done about the border. I think the majority of people in this country think that if you have you need an ID to vote. I don't think that the Republican elites are out of mainstream on those issues.
Well, but, okay, right. But if we go through an issue-by-issue basis. There are some that the elites are in tune with the public on, and some that they are not. But on the vast majority of issues, the elites in both parties are out of touch with the public. The Republicans are more out of touch on economic issues. The Democrats are more out of touch on cultural type issues.
Well, but Sean, what I want to—
That's a different— I'd like you to qualify that. We don't have the time
well,
for that.
Well, I just want to hear from you on— So look, last time, I know that Biden comes in as he's kind of the one who's going to save you from Bernie Sanders or something like that, right? But he pretty immediately comes in and kind of tacks to the left pretty hard. So, you know, in that campaign, you know, people like Mike Bloomberg, a very successful mayor of New York, Howard Schultz, CEO of Starbucks, you know, just total washouts, right?
Exactly.
But the question I have is that given the pain of kind of this 4 years, is there going to open up, you know, kind of a new direction? Kind of like Bill Clinton and the New Democrats, right, at the beginning of the 90s. Is there room for something like that to happen in the Democrat Party?
I think they're going to have to take a much larger defeat or several defeats before that is the case. From the Democrats' perspective, they've won 8 out of the last 9 popular votes for president.
Yeah.
They see that younger people are more Democratic, while older people who are more Republican are dying off. All the energy is on the left. I don't see a correction toward the middle in anytime soon, because it's also the fact that the people who are more likely to lose in November are not the liberals. They are the more moderate members of the Democratic Party, which means they've got no base to push back against
the assumption that every minority group that's going to come in, and as the country becomes increasingly non-white, it will be more democratic. I think there are big questions about
that. I would agree, but that is a topic for
Wait, don't close me out just yet. Okay. One more thing. So what you just said reminded me of something I heard that was hilarious. One pundit said that if it turns out that Hispanics begin voting Republican, which they're beginning to trend more in that direction, that the Democrats will turn around and build the wall so fast you won't.
Well, yes,
you won't believe it.
There,
good one to end on.
Yeah, okay. Well, with that, I'm not going to follow up on. I thank you for listening to us, and I thank both Dr. Ryan and Dr. Baker for discussing. We had a lively discussion with some disagreement, but I think we also did it in a civil manner, which I think is also important. And what we would expect from a filibuster podcast. And with that, I yield back the balance of my time.